You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this past week. And today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television and the Idaho Reports blog online. Margaret Carmel, she is senior reporter for BoiseDev.com. Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief of the Idaho Press and the reporter for the Eye on Boise blog, as well as Kevin Fixler, investigative reporter with the Idaho Statesman. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hey, Gemma.
So, Kevin, I want to begin with you, and I want to talk about a police shooting that happened here in Boise on June 27th. So first, can you just take us back to that day and how the shooting came to be?
Sure thing. And thanks again for having me on. Essentially, the facts that we know are that police were responding to the report of a child abduction. They got a call on the 911 dispatch and were investigating the situation. Shortly thereafter, they end up issuing a series of tweets with a photo of a gentleman they were looking for. And it included a picture of him, as well as that of a 14-year-old boy who they were searching for. And they noted that they believed that he was at risk or in danger. Not long after that, there was word via the tweets that more information would be coming. And through later a news release from police, we learned that just shortly after they issued those tweets, that patrol officers found the vehicle and ended up there was an officer-involved shooting. We're still trying to understand at that point what the facts are, and even today, still learning information, as police have been a little tight-lipped on the information they're willing to release even today.
All right. So we do know, though, that what family and friends have been saying. Now, he is an immigrant, so we've heard that there may have been some language barrier issues. However, Kevin, talk about how the family is calling for transparency. He is part of the Bantu community. They are upset about this. In fact, I believe there was a protest outside of City Hall earlier this week.
Yeah, a couple things there. So the group did organize, and about 50 members plus some supporters of the East African community, the refugee groups here, that includes the Somali Bantu, which you referenced, and also some Kenyans. And they rallied and were out, I guess, in force in front of City Hall on Tuesday. What's really emerged here, and I think kind of the sticking point for that community, is about the narrative that police put out. And what they say, it's a false narrative about this member of their community. His name is Mohamud Hassan Makoma, and he's 33. And he and his family moved here, according to two of his siblings, in the winter of 2004. So they escaped civil war in Somalia. They lived briefly in Kenya before making it to the United States. And the issues that they're presenting here are they want to see the 911 call from dispatch. They want to hear that. And they want to see the body cam footage from the three officers who were later identified involved in the shooting. Police have stated that they will not be releasing those things. And I previously asked for the police records through Boise Police, but all have been denied to this point, stating that it's an ongoing investigation as an Ada County Critical Incident Task Force review by Garden City Police continues.
And there is some talk from his family, Kevin, correct, that he does suffer from some mental health issues. And I believe this is one of the reasons why they would like the 911 tape to be released. And we should note that the ACLU of Idaho, I believe in a statement to the Idaho Statesman, correct, saying that this 911 tape should be released.
Yes, the ACLU of Idaho did chime in and believes that even while these investigations, there's actually a separate independent investigation by the city of Boise. They have a independent Office of Police Oversight that's also reviewing this separate from the critical incident review, I guess just to ensure that protocols and procedures were followed correctly and to see what kind of changes could be made down the road. And that's part of what the local refugee community wants to see as well, more cultural and mental health involvement in decisions by police. So the family has acknowledged that the suspect in this case, who has now been charged with multiple felonies, I should note, and misdemeanors, that he does suffer from schizophrenia and takes medications for that purpose. So they're wondering, did the officers who were involved have the mandatory crisis intervention training that Chief Ryan Lee said last November he would ensure that all members of the force would receive? He told that to the Boise City Council. So unclear, and a Boise police spokesperson has declined to acknowledge or address that question, which I've posed to the department more than once.
And what has your interaction been with the department as you have continued to write about this incident?
Well, again, I mean, it's they're being fairly tight-lipped. And, you know, it's understandable that as an outside investigation or two in this case are underway, they need to be a bit careful. There could be some legal liabilities there. I was told that the family is now considering the hiring of an attorney to explore what's going on. But the police department did just yesterday, on Wednesday, finally acknowledged the name of the suspect. That was something that they kept under lock and key for about 2.5 weeks while this man is at St. Alphonsus Hospital. And that's another fact that the police department wouldn't acknowledge. They wouldn't state where he is, and the hospital also would not acknowledge that he's currently a patient. So we're really grasping at straws for information. Police are saying that they can't release anything because of the ongoing investigation, but that's sort of the crux of the fight here with the refugee community. They want more information. They want release of that information publicly, and they feel like they've hit a wall.
And as you did mention, he was officially charged with a number of crimes yesterday.
Yes. Colleague of mine. Yep. Jacob Scholl with the Idaho Statesman has a story up. We posted about an hour ago, and it details through the criminal complaint the specifics. Beyond that was another factor, actually. It was believed that the suspect had a weapon. We now know that that was a knife, at least according to them. And he had waved that both at the child in the vehicle, as according to police, as well as at officers who then, according to Chief Lee, the quote was, events transpired that compelled the officers to use force once they brought the vehicle to a stop after what was a short chase, again, according to police. So the other very serious charges are that it lewd acts with minors, and it lists children from between ages 4 to 13 years old that he is believed to have been involved with in a sexual nature. Those are obviously felony crimes. In addition, aggravated assault of a peace officer, fleeing the police, and also violation of a protection order, which we're still trying to understand a little bit more about, because according to online court records, a prior protection order against this gentleman had actually lapsed in July of 2017. It does list a new one as of September 9th of 2020, but that was shortly after actually a probation charge had expired. So some of these facts still need to be sorted out. And now that Ada County prosecutors are involved, we should learn more about that as this case continues forward.
And I think it's fair to note, Kevin, that, you know, yes, he has been charged. These are some serious charges against this individual. It muddies the waters a bit, though, when there is information that's not being released. And yes, we can understand it's an ongoing investigation, but we've seen similar cases across the country with 911 tapes not being released, with body cam footage not being released. And in a way, it adds to speculation instead of the facts.
Sure. And that speaks to this demand for more accountability, communication, and transparency from members of the refugee community. And it's a really interesting and complex situation, because they are Africans and they are Blacks in America. And I think, you know, a year after the height of the Black Lives Matter movement across the United States, we're seeing intensified and heightened scrutiny on police departments across the country, kind of questioning the narratives that police often put out and even members of the media consistently accept as truth and fact. But again, this community says that what they know of this man and the details of his life don't match with what police have stated. And so I think the overall thrust of the Black Lives Matter movement has made a lot of people in America, again, including media, pay more attention and ask deeper questions about the facts that police often put out about incidents, including officer-involved shootings.
And we do know that there were three Boise police officers involved in this. They were put on paid administrative leave. That is standard practice. But Kevin, do we know if they are still on paid administrative leave?
We don't. And Haley Williams, the lead spokesperson for BPD, declined to comment about the current status of those officers. Standard practice, according to the department, is to put somebody on for seven working days. And then I believe they go through some protocols to return to work. However, the chief has discretion in order to extend those if need be. And in response to a question about whether or not those officers have returned to duty, she declined to respond to that, saying it was a personnel matter.
I want to thank you for the reporting you've been doing on this. I think you've made a very good point just about having to ask the questions, right? That is what you as an investigative journalist needs to be doing. And, you know, it's to get to the truth and to the facts. So appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Thanks again.
And we'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our reporter roundtable with Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. Melissa, can we start with who's in charge in Idaho? Because apparently Lieutenant Governor McGeehan was at the reins for about 15 minutes yesterday.
Right. So to back up just a little bit, yeah, and I imagine we'll talk a lot more about this later in the program. Lieutenant Governor McGeehan held a press conference yesterday at which she encouraged the legislature to reconvene to address employer vaccine policies and protect people who protect employees who choose not to get vaccinated. During this press conference, she mentioned offhand that at some point on Thursday, she was going to be governor. She didn't know exactly what time and she didn't know for how long. She made that clear very, very quickly. It turned out it was only for 15 minutes, according to Governor Little's spokesperson. Governor Little had to land at the Moscow Pullman Airport, which is just over the border, so he could get to a fire site and a meeting in Troy. So the lieutenant governor, according to the Idaho Constitution, was in charge for about 15 minutes. But as I posted yesterday on Idaho Reports, this isn't the first time there's been confusion over who was in charge and when. The fact that, you know, McGeehan didn't know when exactly she would be acting governor might not have been a problem yesterday, but had the governor been out of town for longer, had the governor been held up for those, I don't know, a Moscow Pullman Highway traffic jam or something like that, she didn't know exactly when she would be in charge. This happened in May when she infamously issued an executive order about, you know, prohibiting local government entities from issuing mask mandates. She didn't realize until I think the day before that she would be acting governor, and at that point she was already out of town on her own vacation, which meant that President Pro Tem Chuck Winder was governor for a day, and it's not clear how he was notified or how long he was governor. This has happened in the past. Betsy wrote a couple years ago about a situation in which everybody in the line of succession was out of town, and nobody was exactly sure who was governor and when they were governor. I think at one point Speaker Scott Bedke was governor, but nobody could reach him because he was out running cattle. And again, the vast majority of the time, this isn't an issue. I asked Governor Little about this in early June when he was on our program,
And he said, you know what, this is how it always works. When I was lieutenant governor, sometimes I got, you know, a long period of heads up. Sometimes, you know, Governor Otter would give him a call in the morning and said, I'm heading to Oregon, you're in charge. And so he doesn't see an issue with the way this line of succession is communicated to the next in charge. And again, most of the time, the executive branch kind of runs itself. It's not the governor doesn't need to be in Boise to make things work in this state. But every once in a while, there might be an emergency and somebody might need a little bit more heads up.
Well, and do you think it's fair to say that
yesterday that while Lieutenant Governor McGeehan was talking at her press conference about how she would be acting governor at some point that day, which drew, you know, some very enthusiastic cheers from her supporters there at her press conference, we found out later that that time period actually had already occurred and had ended 5 minutes before the press conference started.
And can we go back, Melissa, to this press conference and the folks showing up at the State House yesterday? Because this is in regards to private businesses, many of them healthcare organizations, who are now going to require that all their employees be vaccinated against COVID.
Right. This is news that came out last week. Everybody on the three major healthcare providers in the Treasure Valley, St. Luke's, St. Al's, and Primary Health, announced on the same day, as you'll recall, that they would by this fall require all of their employees, including, you know, janitorial staff and nurses and cooks, everybody will be required to get a vaccination unless they have an accepted exemption. You know, they need to actually apply for this exemption. That immediately drew condemnation from some conservative lawmakers who said, wait, this should be up to the individual. A lot of people pointed out that, you know, these healthcare systems already mandate things like flu shots and other vaccinations. That's long been the practice, and nobody has really decried that before. Other people pointed to the fact that Idaho is a right-to-work state, and that, you know, traditionally conservatives say that they prefer these decisions be up to the employer, that they're left up to negotiations between the employee and the employer. And so we're, you know, as you'll recall, the Idaho House never adjourned for the session. They just recessed. They can call themselves back at any time. And Speaker Scott Bedke, you know, was honestly skeptical of doing that. He errs on the side of let's leave this between the employer and the employee. We are waiting right now to hear if the Senate Republicans are in favor of coming back to prevent hospitals and other employers from mandating vaccines as a condition of employment.
Just to add to that, the Senate Republicans were in caucus this morning, a virtual caucus and a very unusual interim caucus. They don't usually hold caucuses when the legislature is not in session. And this was not the only topic that was on their agenda. There were a number of things they wanted to talk about, but this was when they were going to decide whether their caucus was going to support reconvening the legislature on this issue or not. And I understand that that caucus has now ended and they are working on a press release. And I asked the caucus chair, Senator Mark Harris, is it yes or no on reconvening?
Yeah.
And the text that I got said, not right now. So we'll be hearing a little more, but it sounds like, to me, that sounds like a no.
When I was on the phone with Senator Harris, I tried to sweet talk him into giving me a heads up, and he said, we'll find out when the press release comes out. And he made it sound like it would be before two. It could be in this hour. We'll excitedly interrupt if we find out that the legislature is reconvening.
And we should note that we're airing live at noon. So this information, if you're listening at 8 tonight, could be different. So Betsy, you had mentioned that with this caucus, I mean, so this idea of mandating vaccines, certain employers being able to do that, it was not the only thing that they were discussing. Do we know what else they would possibly want to reconvene about?
I actually, so the I think the only question of reconvening was with regard to the vaccine thing, but they just wanted to check in on a whole bunch of different issues. The Senate did adjourn sine die, and there are differing legal opinions as to where the legislative session even stands. This is uncharted territory for Idaho. One house cannot adjourn for more than 3 days without the concurrence of the other house, according to the Idaho Constitution. So the Idaho Attorney General's office issued an opinion saying that since the Senate adjourned sine die, but the House only recessed, in reality, they're both just in recess and they could both come back at any time. Well, a conflicting legal opinion came from Jim Jones, the former Idaho Attorney General and former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who pointed out that the Constitution says that one can't adjourn for more than 3 days without concurrence of the other, and that the House did concur in allowing the Senate to adjourn sine die. And so the result is they are both adjourned sine die. We don't know what a court would say. It's never come up before. And depending on what happens, it could land back in court.
Oh, goodness. All right. I would like to switch gears for a moment, Margaret. And I want to, can you talk to us about a proposed land swap in the city of Boise?
Yes. And if you gave me a full hour, I could probably fill it up with this, this proposal. So I'll try to be as succinct as possible. So last month, news came out that the city of Boise was entertaining a proposal from the Harris family that developed Harris Ranch to swap some land in the foothills for a 160-acre proposed park site that former Mayor Brent Coles helped set up and get a master plan for in the late 90s. The neighbors are absolutely incensed, and so are other people around the city. They're saying that this points to a greater pattern of the city basically taking the resources from the outer fringes of Boise and in its area of impact, and then using that to give more amenities to the higher income people who live in the north and the east ends and Harris Ranch over near the foothills. We had a lot of reporting about this week. And the biggest thing that came out is I spent 3 weeks researching this and putting in dozens of public record requests. And what I found out is that the land that the Harris family proposes to give the city is actually would never be developed anyway. It is the Harris family said, okay, we're going to give you some land in the foothills and some land in Harris Ranch, but the land higher up in the foothills, I don't know as much about, but the majority of the land in Harris Ranch is actually already marked as mitigation on their plan. So because it spans an Idaho power corridor, so it would not be built on anyway. The other part of the deal is that the Harris family proposed to not build as many homes in the foothills as they were going to build anyway. But 2 weeks ago at city council, they got an approval for one of these subdivisions in the foothills. And one of their representatives told the city council that they were capped at building 59 homes in that subdivision instead of over 100 because of the topography of the area and concerns about fire access. So once again, the Harris family said, hey, we'll agree to not build on this land. But public records and show that this land was already, they weren't going to be able to build out to their full entitlement due to the topography. The other thing that, and this whole situation has caused a lot of consternation. We are still waiting for an official appraisal of the worth of the land at the McGurdio Park site, which is the site in Southwest Boise, and the value of the land up in the foothills to see. Because in Idaho, whenever you do a land swap, those land pieces have to be roughly equal. So we don't have an official appraisal, but the nearby earlier this week, we published a story pointing out that the Boise School District has a piece of land, 15-acre piece of land, that is right next door to the McGurdio Park site. Mm-hmm. And it went up for sale for $12 million. So the fact that 15 acres went for $12 million just last week, and you know, it stands to reason that 100 and the 160 acres in the McGirdio Park site will likely be worth more than the $15 million package that the Harris family is proposing. But keep in mind that that appraisal of the land, that McGirdio site, it is not annexed into the city of Boise. Neither is Southwest Boise. So they have not been paying taxes into the development, the potential development of this park. And it has some restrictive covenants on it that were passed in the 90s that says that it can only be a park. Now, I talked to another attorney who told me that the city legally, in his opinion, the city can legally remove those covenants. They put them on, the requirements on themselves. They can take them off. But that adds a further restriction. It also doesn't have sewer or other major connections, which could lower the appraisal value. But we'll see. We don't know what that number is. So, and there is still more to come.
Oh, to say the least. All right. I appreciate that quick update on it, Margaret, because there is a lot to it. So, Betsy, there is a proposal for a new state prison.
Excuse me. That's right. And Idaho has not built a new state prison since 2000. Excuse me. So to me, this seemed like pretty darn big news.
Yeah.
A few years ago, the State Board of Correction approved a plan for a huge prison expansion to the tune of $500 million and a giant new state prison. And it was so controversial, it was just a complete political non-starter. The governor never ended up even proposing it to the legislature. But our prisons have been overflowing. We've been sending inmates out of state for years now. And excuse me.
Oh, Betsy, I feel you, man. Allergies are all over the place with this smoke.
It's the smoke, I think. But
it's the smoke,
so there
yeah.
was a legislative performance audit report that came out a couple of years ago that actually found that Idaho would save money by building new prisons compared to operating the ones it has now, because the old prison facilities are so inefficient and have much greater staffing needs and they're poorly designed that new prisons would actually pay for themselves over time just because of that. So a new proposal has been developed by the Department of Correction. This is their new infrastructure plan. And it does call for building a new prison, but a much smaller one. And it would be an 850 bed women's prison south of Boise. And currently our women's prison is in Pocatello. It would remain there, but that is just medium and close custody for the more serious offenders. And the majority of female inmates in Idaho are already housed in the Boise area in lower security facilities, many of which are converted wings of some of our prisons for men. Well, that has cut down on the available cells and beds for the number one priority and need in the prison system, which is minimum security beds for male inmates. So this plan would allow all those women to be consolidated at this new prison, all those units to be converted back into housing minimum security beds for men. It would also allow for the construction of a new medical unit and several other facilities and remodeling of a couple of other existing prison facilities, aimed at resolving some very long-standing problems that the prisons have had with court cases and population caps on certain outdated prison facilities where they just as soon not run those anymore and upgrade them into something more modern. So overall, this plan would cost between $130 million and $170 million. Oddly, it was $130 million in February. Now it's getting up towards $170 million. This has to do with the price of materials and the way they're skyrocketing right now. But depending on the timing, perhaps that's not a permanent thing. And certainly it takes some time for something like this to go through. The Board of Correction this week unanimously approved this plan. And that's just the first step. Now the Department of Correction and the director will work with the governor's office and the administration to flesh out the proposal and see what the governor might wish to propose to legislators. And if he does propose something along the lines of a new prison, he would do so most likely in the budget that he presents to the legislature in January when they convene for their next session.
And also on the heels of this proposal, Melissa, we're learning about a really serious shortage in staff in our prisons.
Absolutely. The Associated Press and KTBB both reported this week that at an Idaho Department of Correction, at a Board of Corrections meeting earlier this week, The IDOC director told the board members that about one fourth of correctional officer positions were unfilled right now. So we're talking about 150 vacant positions right now. And the AP reports that's the lowest staffing rate the state's seen in 6 years. And so that means that people who are currently working at the prisons are working much longer shifts. It means that it affects the inmate to worker ratio. It's not a safe situation for inmates or workers. And that's what the state is dealing with right now. Just like so many other industries, there's part of this equation is the pay problem. In Idaho, according to the Associated Press, entry level employees start at $16.75 an hour. Across the border in Oregon, that's $22.64 an hour. And so it's still a little bit more than what the average Idaho employer pays for an entry-level position. But if you are a prison worker and you have the ability to go over the border and work at an Oregon facility, that's going to be an attractive proposition for you.
And I should mention, mm-hmm. I also covered that meeting. The prison system pays $15 an hour for entry-level positions, but this is for corrections officer positions, which are more than entry-level. And they are struggling in a big way right now because obviously prisons are a 24/7 operation and they can't shut down. They can't just close a wing or say we'll be closed on Tuesdays. And so what they have done to deal with this in the short term is they are running mandatory overtime. So prison guards who already were working 12-hour shifts might be asked with no notice to extend that to 16 hours. And that happens about twice a week for most of these people. That gives them an 8-hour turnaround before they come back for their next shift. Now, I did inquire, how many days a week do they do this? They typically work 12-hour shifts, 3 days on, 4 days off, 4 days on, 3 days off, that type of thing. So they do get time off on different days, but it is a tough situation. It's hard for me to imagine being in your 16th hour of a shift as a prison guard. It's not ideal. And part of the warning was that this has public safety implications. In addition, it could lead to tension in the prisons if they have to stop movements and just lock everything down because they don't have enough staff to move people around. The prison system does have some proposals to try to address this, including things like sign-on bonuses, retention bonuses, and they have a proposal they're presenting to the governor to raise that starting pay for correctional officers up to $18 an hour. We would still be behind Oregon.
Right. Margaret, you did, you wrote a really compelling story about how the housing crunch is impacting senior citizens. And we've heard this before, Margaret, you know, with property taxes and things like that. But there's a lot of nuance to this.
Yeah, and I think that this connects really well with the wage question we were just having, is that everyone in Idaho, particularly in the Treasure Valley, is just getting walloped by these increases in cost of living and wages not keeping up. But seniors are in a particularly vulnerable position right now because a lot of seniors, they're not working. They're on a fixed income. You retire and that's your Social Security that you're living on. And so a lot of seniors are kind of stuck in this position where they're in a house that their property taxes are going, that maybe they own outright, but their property taxes are going way up. And, you know, they might start having needs for roofing repairs, other things, and they're just barely making it on, you know, property taxes going up. You know, I think we've seen people that have had, you know, over a couple hundred dollar increase in the last 2 or 3 years, which is really quite a lot to swallow if you're just taking home Social Security. Or, you know, I talked to two women for this story who are roommates in the rental market who are concerned about losing their housing. And, you know, they're over 70 living with someone else. And luckily they are friends. They joked to me, they said, well, we get along on politics. Don't know how it would work otherwise. And they're they're in this uncertain rental market, worried that their landlord is going to decide to sell their house or raise the rent, and then they won't have anywhere to go again. So, and whenever you're a senior, you're struggling in this position of, okay, how do you pay for end of life care? Should you sell your mm-hmm. house to pay for end of life care, or, you know, try to rent? What about how to pay for in-home health care? How do you get socialization? And then what if the only place you can afford to rent is, you know, further and further west in Canyon County, where there's no public transit and a lot of older people are not driving anymore because of vision issues or just other problems with their mobility? And so then you end up with people that are kind of trapped in an apartment and not really able to get out and about. And that has a lot of impacts. And so I tried to, in this story, just kind of explore these questions. And the conclusion I came to is, no matter what your situation is as an older person in the Treasure Valley, you don't really have many good options unless you have a family that can afford to take you in and have a room for you, and that is not an option for everyone because of their own issues with rent or cost of living or raising children. Or one of the women I talked to, she has oxygen, she has to rely on an oxygen tank, and her family lives in McCall and she cannot be there because of the altitude. So there's just a lot of difficult questions here.
Yeah, I thought it was a really, really compelling article, Margaret. So Betsy, apparently there is now a statement from the Senate in regards to reconvening the legislature.
There is, and I'm just getting it back up. I just received a text and it disappeared. Let's see. Okay, so they are not calling for reconvening at this point. What their statement says is that with regard to the recent COVID vaccine requirements set by some Idaho healthcare facilities, quote, "As Senate Republicans, we hold firm the belief that state government should not overregulate business. However, individual liberties must be protected to ensure Idahoans are able to work and provide for their families. We call on business leaders, the governor's office, and our colleagues in the House leadership to join with the Senate in a series of meetings to find solutions that will protect the employees, patients, and the viability of our healthcare systems in Idaho. Business thrives when government involvement is limited, and it is our hope that this issue can be resolved before more regulation as a result of legislation needs to be considered." So they're calling for meetings to actually start talking with the healthcare facilities. It was interesting when I spoke with legislators about this in the past week. I actually spoke with six legislators from NAMPA who signed on to a joint statement that initially was perceived as calling for a special session of the legislature. It turned out three of the six did not support calling a special session of the legislature or reconvening right now on this issue, but just had concerns about this issue and wanted addressed. And so in some ways, that seems like that's the position the Senate is taking, is that perhaps they ought to talk to these hospital leaders and find out what's going on.
And the way read this press release, Gemma and Betsy, is it absolutely doesn't rule out legislation during the regular 2022 session. Mm-hmm. It lines up with what the lawmakers you spoke to, Betsy, said, which is, you know, yeah, we do think this is something to be addressed. Maybe not right now. Maybe not bringing folks back.
Agreed. And in some ways, it's a veiled threat that if the hospital systems don't come to the table, legislation may be coming next year.
What's interesting, though, is that my understanding, though, is that the healthcare systems have said that everyone needs to be vaccinated. Isn't it by October?
And September in a lot of cases. September. Yeah, in two of the cases, it was September.
It varies a little bit. And most of the legislators who I talked to, their biggest concern was that the current vaccines that are authorized in the United States have emergency use authorization from the FDA. They don't have full FDA approval, which typically takes several years. But a whole lot of those calling for a special session are saying, why, this is just an experimental drug. How can we let employers force their employees to undergo an experimental treatment? Emergency use authorization, near as I could tell from my research yesterday, it's a little bit more than an experimental drug. An experimental drug is one that has been approved only for testing. It can't be prescribed or sold or advertised. Obviously, this vaccine is being administered to millions of Americans. It has gone, in order to reach emergency use authorization, it had to go through three stages of clinical trials. And that third stage is almost completed, and two of the three companies have already applied for full FDA approval. It's not clear when that final approval will come, but in some ways it's somewhere in between an experimental drug and a fully FDA approved drug. This emergency use authorization, according to the FDA, had very rigorous standards having to do with tens of thousands of people participating in studies and the impacts of the vaccine on them being analyzed and studied and followed pretty closely.
And to add on to what Betsy said, just today, there are national headlines about the FDA granting priority review to both Pfizer and BioNTech for their vaccines. The agency expects the approval decision to happen within the next 2 months. And so by the end of September, this might already be approved. And that would address at least some of the concerns raised by the lawmakers Betsy spoke mm-hmm. to.
I want to talk about something else before we run out of time. And this is about, frankly, a lack of public notice of legislative committee meetings this last year. And Betsy and Melissa, the two of you addressed the legislative council about this. Betsy, can you talk more about this? I do know you have a big story coming out this weekend in regards to this.
I am writing about this in my Sunday column. And we actually asked to get on the agenda of the legislative council representing the Capitol Correspondents Association and the Idaho Press Club, because we found this such a concerning and alarming issue. During this year's legislative session, there were legislative committee meetings scheduled on a moment's notice. There was no notice of many of these. Basically, the public had no opportunity to come, to listen in, even to tune in online, let alone give testimony, because of the lack of notice. And this is a departure from longstanding practice. We believe that the rules of the legislature, the provisions of the Constitution and state law all say this isn't what they should be doing. And very gratifyingly, the legislators took our concerns very seriously. They invited the Chief Deputy Attorney General Brian Kane to give his analysis. And he said, these are valid concerns. Here are some things you might consider. Government is a customer service business, and you've got to weigh the public's interest against your interest in completing your work and finishing the session. And there were a number of legislators on the committee who spoke out about their concerns, particularly the minority Democrats said there were legislative committee meetings this year for meetings, committees that they're on, and they weren't even notified in advance to get there and be on the committee.
Wow.
And Senator Winder, the Senate President Pro Tem, he had never heard that before, and he was very concerned about that and wants it addressed. And I think there was a strong commitment, really from all sides, from both houses and both parties, that they need to do better in letting the public know what's coming so that we can have true public engagement, because we have always had an open legislative process in this state and the people value that. And we don't want to let that go. I don't think anyone wants to.
And this goes beyond just the media being able to cover these meetings. I mean, I think, Betsy, you make a very good point about this is about the public having access to government and being able at certain times to even testify. And if you're not given notice, you cannot engage with the process.
Absolutely. At this session, there was one instance in particular when I remember that there was a city official from Nampa driving as fast as they could to the Capitol to try to testify, but the meeting was called on such short notice they could not get here in time to have any say. There were citizens who I found waiting in the hallways for 3 hours because they heard a rumor there was going to be a meeting, although that no notice had been issued, no agenda. And sure enough, there was a meeting. And because they waited 3 hours, they got in and got to testify briefly. That is not how it's supposed to work. And I sincerely hope that if the rules of the legislature right now are not strong enough to ensure that there's always public notice, that they will be strengthened. And Melissa and I offered to work with the legislature on that in the public interest. And I do think they were receptive, and particularly to the advice from the Attorney General's office about looking at their practices and making sure that they are responsive to the public.
I completely agree with Betsy. The legislative leadership's credit, they were receptive to our concerns, and on a bipartisan level, we're very concerned about the media and the public feeling like they were kind of cut out of the process toward the end of the session.
I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters and our reporter roundtable. Betsy, your article on this will come out in Sunday's Idaho Press. A huge thank you to Melissa Davlin, Betsy Russell, Margaret Carmel, and Kevin Fixler. And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. Our executive producers are Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Friday. I hope you have a really great weekend, and we will see you back here tomorrow. Not tomorrow. I'm not going to work on Saturday. We'll see you on Monday.